70 years ago, Alan Turing laid the foundations of our field. And he had a dream. He dreamt of creating a machine that would be as flexible, as adaptive, as intelligent as the human brain. Now, for most of those 70 years, the field of artificial intelligence has been sort of out of favor, kind of in the doghouse. There was a long time where if you said you did research in artificial intelligence, you would be, it would possibly even be career limiting. Something very interesting has happened, though, in the last 3 years, something very dramatic. And you can get a hint of that by looking at just some of the many books that have been published just in the last 18 months or so. Our Final Invention and Superintelligence and Smarter Than Us. There's a sense in the air that artificial intelligence is no longer something that is centuries away. It's something that is possibly within grasp. A few weeks ago, the BBC devoted a week to artificial intelligence. They had programs, content, interviews, and so on. Everybody's talking about artificial intelligence. So what happened? What happened in the last 3 years to bring about this change? Well, at the heart of this is a revolution in the field of machine learning called deep learning or deep neural networks. So I'm not going to talk in detail about the technicalities of this, but just give you a bit of a flavor for deep neural networks and what they can do and why this has become so exciting. Now, of course, the term neural network is inspired by the neural networks in the brain. And we certainly don't understand or even really begin to understand how the brain works. But the brain provides us with inspiration. The fact that a kilo and a half of jelly consuming a few tens of watts of power can perform these miracles of information processing gives us a sort of an existence proof. But it does more than that. We know some things about how the brain works, and we can use those to inspire new technologies. So at the heart of the way the brain processes information are these electrically active cells called neurons, and they fire and they send electrical signals to each other. And they connect together through special junctions called synapses. And those synapses are really at the heart of the information processing in the brain. Those synapses are adaptive. The strength of those interconnections can adjust as the patterns of electrical activity go by, and that's the primary mechanism by which the brain learns from experience and acquires intelligence. I just want to give you a sense of the scale and complexity of the brain. This is a map of the Amazon rainforest in South America, and there's a map of the British Isles there to give you a scale. And in spite of the extensive deforestation that we all know about, it remains the case that the number of neurons in the brain is roughly the same, within an order of magnitude, as the number of trees in the Amazon rainforest. But more importantly, the number of synapses in the brain, where the information processing and the learning happens, is of the same order as the number of leaves on the trees of the Amazon rainforest. So this is by far the most complex object in the known universe. It's fairly poorly understood, but we know some things about the brain, and we can use those to inspire new technologies. As I said, I'm not going to go into the technicalities of neural networks and machine learning. If you're interested, I can commend this book to you. The physical version is 750 pages, full-color hardback. I think per kilogram, it's the best value machine learning book on the market. What I'm going to tell you is that a few years ago, you would have had to read a book like this, possibly write some code, gather some data, do a lot of computation in order to build your own machine learning solution. At the end of this talk, I'm going to show you that you no longer need to read this book. I'm going to show you a super easy way to get access to the very state of the art of machine learning and artificial intelligence. Obviously, you should still buy the book, you just don't need to read it. So this is a video taken in 2012 in China, and the speaker is Rick Rashid, the corporate vice president who founded Microsoft Research Worldwide. And he's giving a talk in which he demonstrates a system that uses these so-called deep neural networks, or deep learning. Now, deep learning was developed over a 20-year period in the academic world, But the first large-scale application was to this problem of speech recognition, and it was done in a collaboration between the University of Toronto and Microsoft Research. So what you're going to see here is Rick giving a talk to a Chinese audience.
Now, the last step that I want to be able to take in this process is to actually speak to you in Chinese. Now, the key thing there is we've been able to take a large amount of information from many Chinese speakers and produce a text-to-speech system that takes Chinese text and converts it into Chinese language. And then we've taken an hour or so of my own voice, and we've used that to modulate the standard text-to-speech system so that it would sound like me. So what you see now is the result of that change. I'm speaking in English, and hopefully you'll hear me speak in Chinese in my own voice. Again, the results are not perfect. There are, in fact, quite a few errors.
结果并不完美.
There's much work to be done in this area.
在这方面有很多工作要做.
But this technology is very promising.
用这个技术很有希望.
And we hope in a few years that we'll be able to break down the language barriers between people.
数年后，我们希望能够打破人们之间的语言障碍。
So that was 2012, 3 years ago, which in this field today feels like it was sort of the Jurassic era. But just to give you an idea of the context of that talk, for over a decade, in the field of speech recognition, the error rate of speech recognition systems remained essentially constant despite huge research effort. Along came deep learning, and the error rate dropped by 30%, and that transformed speech recognition. And not just speech recognition, translation, speech synthesis, the system you use there, that you saw demonstrated there, uses deep learning throughout. So that was really the beginning, and since then, over the last 3 years, we've seen deep neural networks applied to a tremendous range of problems, and we've seen equally dramatic improvements in the performance of those systems. Another example of the application of deep learning is in image processing, in what we call object recognition. So it's a simple sounding task. Here's an image. We want the system to recognize that there's a bicycle in this image. Now, a few years ago, this seemed like an extremely challenging problem. But today, using deep learning, we can build a system which will classify objects in images with human-level performance. And indeed, we're achieving human-level or close to human-level performance in many tasks through this revolution in machine learning. So let me use this as an illustration to tell you a little bit more about deep learning. So the idea is to take an image as input and have our machine be able to produce a label, in this case to say that it's a bicycle. We call this kind of technology discriminative because it's discriminating between different classes like bicycles and aeroplanes and cows and sheep and so on. So this is how deep neural networks operate. They take data as input and they produce labels as output. They're tremendously successful. They're very fast. They're very accurate. They're revolutionizing many, many different fields. But there's a catch. There's a sort of an elephant in the room. There's a problem with this technology. And the problem is that this technology needs a lot of labeled data. So to achieve human-level performance on object recognition, for example, you will need typically millions of examples of images, and that's easy, there are a lot of images in the world, but each image has to be labeled, and that's typically done by a person or people. People have to go through and label each image according to the category of object. And that's true of all of these discriminative methods. And of course, human labeling of millions of images is expensive and it doesn't scale very well. Could we do better? Well, the brain tells us that we can do better, because as children, we learn to recognize tens of thousands of categories of objects with very little labeled data. We see a lot of unlabeled data. We go around the world and we see dogs and cats and bicycles, but only occasionally does mum or dad say, that's a dog, that's a bicycle. Somehow, the brain can achieve this feat without those millions of labeled examples. Well, again, we don't know how the brain works, but we do know something about the brain, and we can use this to inspire the next generation of technology. So what I'm going to talk about now are things that we don't know how to do, some unsolved problems, but things that we're actively exploring in Microsoft Research, things that we hope will unlock future generations of technology. And one of the things we're looking at is a very different approach to tackling problems in artificial intelligence. It's sort of a back-to-front approach. We call it a generative approach. So the idea is to work in the other direction, to start with the label of a bicycle and then to generate a synthetic image. So you can imagine synthesizing an image that contains a bicycle. And you could do the same for a dog, a cat, and so on. So how would this work in practice? Well, supposing I gave the machine millions of images of everyday objects, but without any labels. What could it do? Well, it could analyze that data, and it could discover that those images form clusters. Now, one of those clusters would correspond to images of bicycles. It wouldn't know that those are called bicycles. It would just know they form a cluster. If we had one labeled image in that cluster, it could infer that all of those images contain bicycles. So we label the whole cluster with just one example. So generative methods could deal with classification problems and other machine learning problems without using labels. But there's a problem, an elephant in the room, of generative methods as well. Let's think what would happen if we apply a new image and we ask it to classify that image. Well, in principle, all it has to do is search over the different labels. It could try bicycle, try cow, try aeroplane. When it tries, let's say, bicycle, it has to try lots of different colors of bicycle, sizes, shapes, positions, orientations, lighting, background, and so on. But it could try all the possibilities until it finds one that matches the observed image, the input image. And at that point, it would know there's a bicycle. So in principle, it could solve this problem with very little labeled data. But in practice, of course, the number of images is vast. The number of images that you and I would agree represent a bicycle is far, far, far larger than the number of atoms in the universe. So we can't literally search that space. So the problem with these generative approaches is that we have a huge computationally expensive search problem. This is rather interesting. We have discriminative methods, which are very fast, very accurate, but they need lots of labeled data. We have generative methods, which don't need much labeled data. They too might be accurate, but they're very slow. It's a sort of a yin and a yang. These are complementary approaches. One of the things we do know about the brain is that it has both discriminative aspects and generative aspects. So can we combine them? This is one of the things that we're actively looking at in Microsoft Research right now. We're a long way from solving this, but we've made some interesting progress that I'll show you in a moment. So the idea is the following. Could we build a discriminative system which is trained not on expensive human-labeled data, but trained on synthetic data from a generative system? So that generative system can generate unlimited amounts of labeled data for free. You start with bicycle, you generate lots of bicycle images. Then you go to aeroplane, you generate lots of aeroplane images. All of those images are labeled as either bicycle, aeroplane, and so on. Generate as many of those as you like automatically. So the generative system is going to produce the data to train the discriminative system. But we have this enormous search problem. Every time we have a new input image, we have to search over that space of labels in the generative approach in order to work out which category it belongs to. But the discriminative approach, once it's trained, is very fast. Given a new image, it can very quickly tell us where in that space of labels to look in order to find the solution. So, can we use a generative method to provide the labels to train the discriminative method? Can we use a discriminative method to speed up the search of the generative method? Well, I'm going to show you two examples, one of each, which indicate that this might be possible. It suggests that we're making some progress in this direction. So here's the first example. This is the Kinect sensor, which of course is a depth sensor. So it takes a video consisting of frames. Each frame is a depth image. So here the grayscale represents distance from the camera, and the green is just a threshold of distances that lie above a certain value. That represents the background. So that's the depth image, which is the input. And in Kinect, we use a discriminative classifier to label each of the pixels according to which body part it represents. So that's a discriminative method. Now, we can get labeled data by renting a Hollywood motion capture suite in which somebody makes a body pose. We capture the depth image, and they're wearing a special suit with sort of ping pong balls on the joints, lots of cameras, a lot of 3D processing, and we extract the 3D position of the skeleton. That's expensive, and in fact, it would be prohibitively expensive and time-consuming to capture all the different body poses for all the different body sizes and shapes and clothing and self-occlusion and out-of-frame body parts and so on. So what we do instead is to build a generative model that can synthesize those images. The body poses are taken from a real motion capture suite, but everything else is synthesized. And so that's a generative technique being used to generate data to train the discriminative method. And this was used on the very first release of Kinect. So this is the actual data, in this case a million images, that we used to train the very first version of Kinect. So you see here a huge variety of body poses, body sizes, shapes, and so on. Each has been labeled according to the body parts. And they've been laid out to spell Kinect. So that's synthetic data from a generative approach being used to train a discriminative method, and here's the end result. The input depth image at the top, and the output is the inferred body parts, and from that we get the joint angles. What about the other way around? Can we use a discriminative method to speed up the search of a generative approach? Well, here's an example of a research project that's very much underway in Microsoft Research. And the idea is to do something rather like Kinect, but not applied to the whole human body, but applied to a hand. So our goal is to build the world's best hand tracker. So the idea is we take depth image of the hand as input, and then the output is the 3D pose of the hand. So we want to use a discriminative method, and we could use something rather like Kinect, and it works okay, but it doesn't work well enough. The problems are, first of all, the hand tends to be a small part of the image, and so there are relatively few pixels. But more importantly, the fingers look very similar, very easy for the computer to confuse them. And then finally, we want to achieve very high accuracy, because one of the applications of this is very fine motor control in virtual environments. So we need to do something better than the generative approach alone could deliver, and so we used than the discriminative approach could achieve, and so we used a generative approach. So the generative approach says the following: choose a hand pose, so about 26 degrees of freedom in the hand, so choose a place in that 26-dimensional space and generate the corresponding depth image. So the depth data is in red, the model is in blue, and for this pose, you can see the fit is not very good. The green region is where it matches. This is a different pose with much better fit. So you could search the space of hand poses until you find a good fit to the data, but that would be computationally very expensive. So what we do is we use the discriminative method to give a good initialization, and then we do a little bit of search. So what I'll do now, if we can just switch to this demo. So in the top right, you can see my hand. In the top right, you can see the skeleton being tracked. And in the bottom left, if you prefer to look at that, you see the reconstructed hand. And so this is now tracking my hand in real time, and it's working with very high precision by using a generative method that's fine-tuned to the data, but the discriminative method is giving a very good initialization so that it's very fast. The generative method only has to do a little bit of fine-tuning. Okay, if we can go back to the slides, please. So I've given you a little bit of a hint in this talk of the future of machine learning and some of the research that we're doing, but I want to end by telling you how you can access today state-of-the-art machine learning and artificial intelligence in a super easy way. And this is through Project Oxford. So we launched Project Oxford back in March with a number of APIs in vision, speech, and language, doing things like face detection and recognition, estimating the age and gender, speech to text, text to speech, and Lewis is particularly interesting, the language understanding system, which uses either pre-built models from Cortana, or it makes it super easy for you to create your own bespoke language models. Today, though, I'm incredibly excited to announce 5 new APIs. The first 3 will be launched by the end of the year. First of all, we have video tracking of faces, so extensions of video functionality, including detection of motion and stabilization of shaky videos. We have the Custom Recognition Intelligence Service, which allows you to customize speech recognition to difficult environments, noisy environments, for example, and or to customize, for example, to particular dialects and other challenging situations. And then speaker recognition, which allows you to recognize the identity of the speaker, given a sort of audio fingerprint of their voice. Available today for you to try is the spell checker, which is automatically updated, including slang, brand names, difficult to spot errors. And finally, but not least, the emotion API. And I think the best way to explain the emotion API is with a demo. So if we can switch to the demo. So let's, so what it's going to do is detect my face and then classify my emotion. Okay, so that's a 80% confident that's a neutral expression. Let's try something else. Oh, happiness, that's pretty confident. This can actually use several people. Now, I think Anna is somewhere in the audience. Anna, where are you? Anna, come, Anna, yes, come on up stage. And is Andrew still here? Andrew, come on up. So we'll have a little go with 3 of us. If you want to stand fairly close. If you want to stand there. So we just need to get 3 of us in shot. Come up a little bit closer, that's great. Okay, you ready? Okay, big smiles. Okay, that's pretty good. Thanks, guys. So that's Project Oxford. That's available to you today to use. You can try it, that Emotion API. You can try out some of the other APIs. The rest of those APIs will be available by the end of the year. And this really is incredibly easy to use. We just say 3-in-1. With as few as 3 lines of code, you can make a call to one of those APIs and build some of that state-of-the-art machine learning and artificial intelligence into your application. And with just that 1 API call, you can deploy this across any platform. So it's incredibly flexible. So please do go and try that today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris. So we heard a couple of topics there, and you spoke about generative and discriminative artificial intelligence. Do you think that ultimately with the combination of the two of those, we will get to some sort of human level artificial intelligence?
Right, great question. So really what I was talking about there is what I see as the next phase of research. So we've seen this sort of revolution in machine learning through these discriminative methods, in particular deep neural networks. They've just transformed things like speech recognition, object recognition, many other fields. But we have this big problem of the labeled data. So the next task for us is to solve that data labeling problem, and that's where we see the generative methods coming in. So this is kind of a roadmap for the next 5 years. But of course, deep down, all of us harbor this idea of building truly intelligent machines. To do that, we're going to need to do way, way more than anything I've just described. So the human brain is capable of all kinds of planning tasks, high-level reasoning. We exhibit common sense. We can discover not just statistical correlations in data. We can discover causation in data. We can work out what thing is causing what and how to intervene in the world in order to change something. All of these things are things we have ideas, we're doing research, there are papers being published, there are ideas being tried, but we're still a long, long way from anything that comes close to the level of the human brain. So my personal guess is that we will get to true human-level artificial intelligence. I think it will happen this century. I'm guessing maybe 50 years away. I like to think that the breakthrough in deep neural networks sort of took us about 2% of the way towards human-level artificial intelligence. So there's plenty of work to do, over the next few decades. But I see no reason at all why we wouldn't ever one day get to human-level artificial intelligence.
Okay. And I often say that as technologists, we are quite bad at coming up with new ideas. Where do you think the need for us to have things like artificial intelligence comes from? Is it something that maybe we've read in science fiction and so we want to bring it to life? Or is this something that someone's had a genuine business need to create these algorithms for us?
I think it's two things, really. I think, first of all, it's tremendously inspiring, the fact the brain can do this. The brain has capabilities that wildly exceed any technology that we have today. And so understanding the brain, for me at least, is one of the most exciting open problems in science. You know, we understand the universe from the tiniest length scales, subatomic particles, to the structure of the whole universe. We understand the universe's history from microseconds after it was born in the Big Bang to the present time and to its future billions of years hence. And yet we have this sort of everyday object. There are thousands in this room, and yet we don't understand how it works. So I think the motivation is to try and understand the brain because it's intellectually fascinating. At the same time, as we follow that long and fascinating journey, at every step on the way, we will discover how to create new and better technologies. And so one of the things we're trying to do in Microsoft Research and in Microsoft is to democratize those technologies, as you saw with Project Oxford, to sort of very quickly make these available to a wide range of developers and ultimately to everybody on the planet. Mm.
Yeah, and actually, I think that's the key thing there, that we are democratizing machine learning and enabling anybody, people who maybe aren't necessarily used to working with these technologies or these languages, we're able to give these opportunities to people to place into their products.
Right, so I think, I mean, as a society, we face enormous challenges, and I have no doubt that these kinds of technologies can help us address many of those challenges. So we're going to need all the help we can get in the 21st century, and machine learning, artificial intelligence, has the potential to be one of the most powerful technologies that humanity's ever created. It makes me very excited. But at the same time, it's a journey where every step of the way brings new benefits.
Right, and then, so just finally, what other exciting things are you seeing coming up in the world of artificial intelligence at the moment?
Oh, wow, okay, lots of things. Let me just give you one thing. I said that deep learning sort of revolutionized speech recognition, speech synthesis, image understanding. One of the things that's happening right now is very exciting combinations of these. So if you take a system which will take an image as the input and classify it as the output as a car, aeroplane, and so on, it goes through these many, many layers of neuron-like processing. That's why it's called a deep network. So it's doing some incredibly complex nonlinear processing that's very, very hard to understand. How can we sort of peer into that network and see what's going on? It's very difficult. We can visualize when we see these patterns, but it's hard to understand what's really going on. But one of the things we can do is just have the system tell us what's going on. We can take another neural network that has been trained to generate speech, and as input, instead of taking text, we can take some of the hidden layers of this neural network that's looking at objects in images. And so what we're seeing now are neural network systems which can take an image of a scene and then describe what's going on in that scene in natural language. Not just saying there's a bicycle and a cow and a car, but actually talking about almost the meaning, I hesitate to use that word, but giving us more insights into what's actually going on in that scene. So I think that's amazingly exciting.
Mm. I think it's fascinating work. Thank you. Everyone, please put your hands together again for Chris.